Good day. This is Dr. Douglas Beck. I'm an audiologist. And today on the Hearing Matters podcast, we're featuring my dear friend, Dr. Ron Levitt. Dr. Levitt received his BS and his MS from the University of Arizona and his doctorate from the Arizona School of Health Sciences. He is the recipient of the Larry Maltin Award for Excellence in Teaching from Beltone, Best Audiologist in the Western U.S. from Rayovac, and winner of the AudioScan Challenge for Best Hearing Aid Validation Protocol. Now, that turns out to be critically important in this discussion. During his 46 years in practice, Dr. Levitt has worked as Director of Audiology for the Tucson Unified and Amphitheater School Districts, Audiologist for University of Arizona Medical School, Instructor at University of Arizona Speech and Hearing Department, Director of the Austin Regional Cooperative for the Hearing Impaired Program at UT Austin, Audiologist for the Tacoma Public School System, Director of Audiology at Ron obviously cannot hold a job. Director of Audiology at Oregon State University, Audiologist for Good Sam Hospital in Corvallis, Oregon, Senior Instructor at Oregon State University, Consultant for the U.S. Forest Service and American Bar Association for ADA, American with Disabilities, Compliance, and has been in private practice for 28 years. And he's published numerous chapters and textbooks and periodicals. And Ron, it's great to have you. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I always enjoy working with you.
Oh, you're very kind. I appreciate that. So, Ron, I don't remember when you and I met, but I'm thinking it's been like 20 years, 25 years.
And, easy.
Yeah, and we're both musicians. And I started reading a lot of your work, must have been about, back in 2011, 2012. And then I saw that paper that you did with Carol Fletcher, The Importance of Audibility in Successful Amplification of Hearing Loss. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that, because you did a survey of major manufacturers, and tell us what you did and what you found.
Well, at the time, as you know, there were six big manufacturers, and they had, as they all do, a premium level, a medium level, and a basic level of technology. And so we asked them to send us their premium level of their most current technology, and I had a sense that the manufacturer's best fit was really not that best. So what we did is we first used the manufacturer's best fit, entering all the client data of hearing aid experience, use and age, et cetera. And then we looked to see how well they did on the bilaterally aided quick speech and noise test with these fittings. And we also looked at the real ear data to see the extent to which they had achieved an NAL target, because we were using their software saying it was doing an NAL fitting. So we wanted to see how NAL it was, if you will. And come to find out, it wasn't very NAL. By and large, they were largely underfit. Critical frequency regions.
And so this is such an important founding thought that audiologists, hearing aid dispensers, otolaryngologists, when you're going to a first fit and you haven't done a real ear, you may have a brilliant program, and it may have been designed to perfectly fit NAL, NL2, or DSL5 or whatever. But if you don't have any due consideration for the real ear anatomy of that ear, it's kind of a guess. It's a first fit best guess based on averages of hundreds and hundreds of ears. That's great, but your ear is not average. Nobody has an average ear.
Old professor used to say, if you put one foot in boiling water, one foot in freezing water, on average, you're comfortable. But that's the problem with averages. Right. It doesn't apply to the individual. It's a group data.
Yes,
And we'll talk more about that when we get to the ACHIEVE study, which I think is important that we touch on. But be that as it may, so we looked to see how these individuals performed with the best fit using the NAL target provided by the manufacturer software, which, as I said, was not very NAL after all. It was really quite underfit in a number of critical frequency regions, almost across the board on every single subject.
Which is rather startling. Yeah.
So you would expect then that because we had not filled in all the gaps of aided audibility, that these folks would have problems on the quick speech and noise test, because here you have a female voice, and you'll see from our data that they were particularly underfit in the high frequencies, and you've got background noise, the two things that hearing aid users often complain about. I don't hear my wife well, I don't hear my grandchildren well, and in noise, forget about it. So we expected there would be not as good a performance based on the real ear data of these manufacturer-generated alleged NAL targets. And that, in fact, was the case. They didn't perform very well. But as I said to you, I used the six big manufacturers' premium technology at the time, but then as a foil and unbeknownst to the subjects, I also put in a 20-year-old Siemens Infinity 3 analog single microphone, no noise reduction, single channel hearing aid as a foil. And I didn't look at manufacturer's best fit for that, but I did program it to a full NAL target. And we looked at the results with that hearing aid compared to the premium hearing aids fit to manufacturer's best fit. And as you know, it didn't turn out well. Then we thought, well, certainly hearing aids have advanced in the last 20 years. So let's program them to where we essentially fill in the aided audibility gaps, which we did. We achieved NAL target on all the subjects. And then we just ran new quick speech and noise test in the bilaterally aided condition again to see how they did. And in many instances, and this is, I think, important information to manufacturers, we were improving the signal-to-noise ratio loss in the magnitude of 12 to 15 dB.
Which is extraordinary. That's a huge, huge improvement.
So, and as you pointed out before, directional mics in the real world can't come anywhere close to that. So if you could just give good audibility, fill in those aided gaps, as I said before, you can have an immense benefit to the patient.
Yes, this is, and to put some and to put a handle on some of this, typical digital directional microphones, if well fitted, are going to improve the signal to noise ratio by 2 or 3, perhaps 4 dB, if the stars align, if everything's perfect.
Right.
So when you're talking about, you know, double digit improvements in SNR, that's huge. That's unbelievably good.
Yes. And so that got us thinking, though. I wonder how pervasive that was. This is our next study. I wonder how pervasive this achievement of the NAL target, real ear verified NAL target, is in the general populace. Because we had been seeing a lot of people who hadn't been particularly well fit. In fact, we'd been seeing a number of people who were wearing hearing aids that didn't have any benefit over the unaided condition, which gave us concern. And we'll talk more about that in just a minute. But we look to see, I wonder how pervasive this is. And first along comes Ryan McCreary, Ruth Bentler, and Patricia Rausch, 2013.
Boys Town National Institute, yes.
Yeah, they say 55% of hearing aids do not meet their plus or minus 5 dB target at critical speech frequencies in children in 9 different states. So now I'm starting to get a sense that there's a national problem, not just a local problem. So then we got together 179 hearing aids on 93 patients from 24 facilities throughout Oregon and looked to see how close they were coming to that NAL target. And because we'd already established that achieving it gives you some benefit by filling in the aided audibility gaps in the previous study that we were just talking about. And what we discovered was that 2.7% of those hearing aids were fit using Ryan McCreary's 5 dB plus or minus target to that NAL target. So we're showing even worse results with adults. Then along comes Sidlowski and her colleagues at Cleveland Clinic, and they are reporting that these people who are showing up for cochlear implants actually were not candidates for cochlear implants at all. They just had hearing aid programs that were doing virtually nothing for them. And when reprogrammed appropriately before doing the cochlear implant, they discovered they were nowhere near cochlear implant candidates. In fact, some of them were scoring 90%+ on the AZ bio and the bilaterally aided condition once properly programmed.
Is it fair to say then that in your experience, quite often 90-95% of the hearing aids that are being worn out in the field are not being fitted to target, and the patients are not really getting the full benefit of that fitting. However, I would bet that most of those fittings, the patient said, oh, yeah, that sounds pretty good. And since the person fitting them did not fit them using real ear measures, they really had no idea how close they were or were not to the actual NAL, NL2, or DSL targets. Because there's, if you're not doing it using best practices, if you're not fitting hearing aids using real ear measures, you're doing that other protocol, which I like to refer to as guessing.
Yes. And you and I had talked previously, my minor was mathematics, so I'm always looking at mathematical implications. And this maybe relates to OTC and professionally fit hearing aids. If you look at the average manufacturer's software, you'll see somewhere between 4 to 16 channels of adjustment. And in those channels, you'll see gain for 50 dB inputs, that's SPL, 60 dB inputs, and 80 dB inputs, somewhere around there. Almost universally throughout the big six manufacturer software, this is what you'll see. And in each of those boxes, let's just take an example that I used in a previous publication. If you have 9 channels and you have 4 levels of settings, you have gain for 50 dB inputs, gain for 60, gain for 80, and MPO control. So in each of those boxes, if you assume you only have 10 choices, and most of them have more than 10, but for ease of computation, let's assume you just have 10 little choices you can make in each box. If you then assume that somehow you're going to luck into an NAL real ear verified target, you have a 10 to the 36th power likelihood of hitting that. 1 in 10 to the 36th power. So that, like you said, guessing is generous. I can guess what the numbers on the lottery are going to be, and I'll have a lot better chance than hitting an NAL NL2 target at those 3 input levels.
That's a very, very important analogy. I'm so glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, well, that's what all that math did for me. That's one of the things I took away.
All right, but then
go ahead.
So then in 2017, you did a article that was in Hearing Review, and this time it was Ron Levitt, Ruth Bentler, and Carol Flexer. And in that one, you had that's the study that you're referring to here, is that 97.7% of subjects showed deviations from NAL NL2 in excess of 5 dB in both ears. And you know, one of the things that people say to me often is, I don't do real ear, because when I put it on target, people don't like it. What's your response to that?
They don't. And in fact, I'm always a little bit amazed when I read in studies, and I can think of 3 right off the top of my head that are very well published and have been discussed at length, but this part, not so much. They take new hearing aid wearers, in other words, people who have never used hearing aids, and they bring them to an NAL NL2 target with mild to moderate hearing losses. So let's just concentrate on the moderate for just a minute. So let's say you got a 50 dB pure tone average. Okay, you're moderate by the Clark Asha method of computing, and you would be maybe even into the moderate severe area if you're using the World Health Organization classification system. But either way, let's just take a 50 dB pure tone average in both ears. And you bring these people in and you set them to a full NAL NL2 target. Yikes. And they wear it. This is not consistent with my experience. If we tried that with people, they would have great difficulty on that first week, 2 weeks, month, it varies, wearing those things at all. So I'm always amazed by that. And, you know, you really hit on something important. If we believe that getting these people to this target is just going to be a one and done, as Frank Lynn had described it, I think you're sadly mistaken. I think you're going to have a lot of people very unhappy, and you're going to have to work them into that with a lot of counseling and maybe even several programs where you step it up little by little until they get there, because it is very inconsistent with my experience that you can take a new user who has substantial hearing loss and put them in an NAL and L2 fitting and have them walk away happy.
So what's the right way to manage that? Because if you know that if you hit target, they're not going to like it.
Right.
But you know the target is important because now you're filling in those audibility gaps. Yes. How do you approach that, Ron?
I have a perfect example. One of my friends is staying here with me right now who has significant hearing loss and never worn hearing aids before. And since she came from far away, we put program one at half NAL and L2, program two at three quarters NAL and L2, and program three full bore. And at her rate, she can decide when she's ready to move up each step. And the beauty of remote programming, as you know, is that I can take, once she gets there, program three and move it to one. So, and I can get rid of the other two and life is good. Fully correct.
I love that. I think that's a great approach. What about adaptation managers? Because many of the manufacturers will have, you know, you can set a certain gain as the goal and you approach it slowly over multiple weeks. How does that work for you?
Well, my concern is that some people, this takes a year. And some people, I'll give you a funny example. I have one of my audiology assistants is a lifelong hearing aid wearer. And she had moved to the coast of Oregon and her hearing aid had gotten broken. But she was so busy getting everything picked up and ready to move again that it had been 2 months since she had worn hearing aids. And boy, she's really severely impaired. So 2 months without hearing aids. And then she came back to work. And so I said, okay, let's get some new stuff on you. And we'll put it on to that NAL, NL2 target that you've always used since you were a baby. You've been NAL or DSL-IO. But since your adult life, you've been wearing NAL and L2. So I'm going to put you right back. It's just been 2 months. Oh, no. The first day. Oh my gosh, she said, this is way, way too loud. Here's the punchline that was funny about adaptation, though. The next day, she said, could you give me just a little more? 1 day of adaptation. Okay, so there's the extreme. All my life, I've worn hearing aids at a full correction, real ear verified. And now I've been 2 months without it. First day, wow, overwhelming. There's no way I can do this. Tomorrow, oh, can you give me a little more? So there's that. There's the 1 day adapter, but we've got a whole clinic full of 1 year adapters.
Yeah.
So I would prefer to let them step it at their, and of course we're following them during this time. We don't just send them off, but, I would prefer to let them move at their rate because that is going back to our average result thing, you know, the freezing water and the boiling water in the buckets, on average, it probably takes months. In fact, Glick and Sharma did a study and said that after 6 months, they had achieved great findings in cognitive improvements with their subjects who had been wearing hearing aids minimum of 6 hours a day for 6 months, who were, by the way, at a full NAL and L2 correction. I'm good with that. And they also showed some cognitive benefits had been obtained during that 6 month period and some change of resource allocation of the brain. Specifically, they were no longer using the memory and reasoning area to fill in the gaps on the bilaterally aided quick speech and noise test. They were once again using the auditory area. So reallocation had occurred in this 6 month period. But again, that's average subject time. And she said to me when I asked, it probably happened quicker for some and slower for others. And therein lies the problem. I don't know how quick it's going to happen on anybody. And it's somewhere between one day and sometimes even more than a year.
I think you're right. But the thing here is that each patient is an N of one. Each of them will adapt or acclimatize at their own rate. And it's going to be dependent on lots of factors that are uncontrolled variables. What is the conversation they're having? Who are they having that conversation with? Is it low stress, high stress? How are they doing with their hearing loss? Are we filling in the gaps? Have we achieved audibility? You know, all of these factors that eventually lead to comfort and acceptance. And if you're just setting the hearing aid on full on gain, I mean, that's probably like driving your car at 110 miles an hour. You know, it could probably do that. But it may not be a good thing to do that as soon as you get your learner's permit, you know?
Yes.
Anyway, so Ron, we could talk about this stuff forever because there was that 2015, article, it was great. It was one more reason why probe mic verification is crucial in any best practice protocol by Sanders, Studi, Weber, Gus Mueller. There was that study by Mike Valente out of Wash U. I guess that was 2018 or 2019, where I'm going to guess at this. I haven't looked at the study in a couple of years, but they had maybe 20, 25 patients, and they fit them all to first fit. And the patients went about their lives, and many of them said, oh, this is fine. Thank you very much. And then they brought them back and they fit them to real ear targets. And I think all but one patient said, oh my gosh, this is so much better.
Well, and you know, you reminded me of something I said I was going to comment on earlier. I was very impressed, as many were, with the Humes data of 2017.
Yeah, Larry Humes.
Yeah, he set three groups out with clinical tests and user self-reports of hearing aid benefit. And in one group, he used the audiology best practices, meaning real ear verification and all that Valente and colleagues specified as best practice. Another group, and this is, you know, not exactly what happened, but essentially picked out their own hearing aids based on some preset programs that probably would have been in the ballpark of what they needed. And then a third group where he put hearing aids on them with virtually no amplification. They were wearing hearing aids whose aided audibility and unaided audibility ratings by real ear were exactly the same. There was no benefit. And here's the part that really impressed me. Let's talk about those subjects a bit. They were all adults. They had done cognitive testing. There was no cognitive problems in any of those subjects. There were 51 in each of the three groups. And each of them had, on average, a master's degree. So these are highly educated people, financially secure, and no cognitive problems. Of those people wearing hearing aids with no amplification whatsoever, 37% said, I will give you $1,800 per hearing aid for these hearing aids. I'm satisfied. My performance is good enough for me. And that got me concerned. And we see this a lot. Yesterday, we saw two people who are wearing hearing aids with no improvement in the unaided condition over the unaided and the aided condition over the unaided condition. Yeah. That's and they've been wearing them for years. Right. And one of them was a physician, one of them was a veterinary. So these are people highly educated, no cognitive problems, youngish, you know, by my standards. They were in their 50s. So this is not that uncommon. I'm concerned that there maybe are 37% of people in this country out there wearing hearing aids with no amplification whatsoever and quite satisfied with it. And this is the getting back to what we were just talking about. If you try to push them up with amplification, I think sometimes you have a harder battle with them than you do with people who have never worn hearing aids and you're just starting from scratch because their norm has been developed very strongly for what sounds right.
Yes. It sounds. And I think you hit on an important point is that many hearing aids that are actually out there malfunctioning, nobody knows about, right? Because people are wearing them because they're used to them. They think they're supposed to wear them, and they are. But the hearing aid not hitting target or malfunctioning is a very, very difficult thing for a user to be aware of. But my concern was always for the patient is that, you know, in medicine, what we always say is diagnosis first, treatment second. And when we're allowing the patient or encouraging the patient to self-diagnose, I think we're gonna have a lot of missteps.
Let's take a quick break. Running a private practice is challenging, and it's especially difficult if you're using a management software system that's out of date or doesn't really fit your needs. As a former private practice owner, I personally found Cycle to be such an incredible tool that is easy to use and is really in the best interest of my patients. Cycle provides you with industry-specific workflows and features for a smooth running front office. And if you've been listening to the Hearing Matters podcast, you will know that I believe that the front office staff is really the most important position in a hearing care clinic. Learn more at cycle.com. That's S-Y-C-L-E.com. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
I agree with you completely, and many of my colleagues do. Diagnostic audiology has existed for these many years because it is providing a very important service. We don't know what we're fixing until we know what the problem is. Yeah. So I'm completely with you on that. And in fact, you and I and Carol have an article out on this subject.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, it came out in August of 23, and I believe it's in the Hearing Review. Yeah. Ron, and then I before I let you go, I know you've been involved in another large survey research project. I wonder if you can just encapsulate that for me in the next couple of minutes. What did you recently research, and what were your findings?
Well, you know, in the study where we looked at the fittings of hearing aids in Oregon, we had a few people from other states. We get people from a variety of places at our clinic. And there weren't enough of them to really put them into the data set. But as time has gone by, we've gotten more and more people in that data set. So we're now starting to look at how well our hearing aids fit on adults across the country. And we're getting more states in the data set, as well as more people from Oregon. And the results are not encouraging in terms of the quality of hearing aid programming. The real ear aided measures for people in states other than Oregon, these adults that we're seeing, are not any better than what we're seeing in Oregon. And I want to get, you know, we had 93 patients from Oregon, from 24 facilities, 179 hearing aids. We're well above that. We're in the 300s now for people in Oregon. So our data set has expanded considerably, and we were able now to look a little bit at some of the neighboring states to see how well hearing aids are fit, because people move to Oregon for a variety of reasons, and then we have their hearing aids fit in these other states where they've come from, and it gives us an opportunity to see how pervasive this poor fitting or this underfitting, if you will, so I don't put a value judgment on it, this underfitting of hearing aids is how common it is. And it's not just an Oregon problem, as Ryan McCurry told us with children, but the problem with adults, I think, is even more significant than he reported for children. He said 55% of hearing aids didn't match their criteria of an adequate fitting. Our numbers are, as you know, much higher than that and continue to be much higher than that. And as soon as we get enough of the other states and the data set swells to a sufficient level to have lots of power, we'll be publishing that again. But what I am seeing is from what we've seen over the last, it's been 6 years since that publication, is that things haven't gotten any better and at a national level.
Previously, we're about 95-97% underfit. Is it still looking like we're in that ballpark?
Yes. Yes. Okay. And there's a large number of people who are wearing hearing aids with no improvement in aided SII over unaided SII.
Yeah, and that's speech intelligibility index. What are your take-home points, Ron? What would you say that the average hearing aid dispenser or audiologist ought to be paying attention to?
Well, you know, you and I have been talking about this real ear aided thing since we had, we were a little younger when we started that discussion. I remember sitting, Mead Killian and I were in San Diego, and we saw the Rastronics real ear aided measurement system. And we said, you know, I think this was 79. We said, you know, this is going to make everything we do obsolete. We're going to be doing this on every hearing aid. We were so wrong, you know.
Well, the Rastronics was one of the very first systems out there.
And
it was brilliant. I remember being very excited by it as well. But if you were to say to an average hearing care professional, this is the problem that we have quantified in a national database. The problem specifically is that hearing aids are being underfitted. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
And what we recommend is, what would you
filling
would you
the say? Aided gaps? And you
filling
know,
the aided gaps. Yeah.
I'll go back to my colleague and mentor James Jerger and his lab assistant Thielen, who in 1967, there were no real ear systems, but what they did is they looked at the 2cc coupler outputs of various hearing aids. Sure. And they discovered that those hearing aids who had very peaky and valley responses, they called it the index of response irregularity. Those that had a very irregular response were yielding poor scores on the aided synthetic sentence index of theirs. Right. So that's speech and noise, in other words. Their findings were that even the 2cc coupler data was telling them in 1967, that if you have these gaps, these aided gaps, it's going to compromise speech understanding and noise. Well, geez, they were about 50 years ahead of their time, you know.
Let me ask you one last question before I let you run. In the recent publications that have come out on the ACHIEVE study, because when I initially read the article and I did a series of interviews with Dr. Jennifer Deal, the epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins, we were talking only at that point about the people who were actually in the primary study, which was looking at people who received excellent counseling versus people who received amplification. And in that part of the study, I believe they all had premium hearing aids. And what they found is no difference, that excellent counseling, you know, a really good health awareness counseling and well-fitted hearing aids both benefited the same, which I think is makes good intuitive sense to me. However, as you were saying, the people who are most at risk for cognitive decline, people with lower socioeconomic, people with less education, people with comorbid factors, those are the people who, when fit appropriately to NAL and L2 targets, they had 47-48% less cognitive decline over the three-year period. If I'm saying that correctly, I hope I am.
Well, as you know, Jennifer Deal is quite a statistician and insists that we make sure to clear to people that that's, again, average population data. For the individual, it doesn't apply. But I would say this about that. This is where she and I differ a little bit. I would say, if you tell me that there's a chance that I would have a 48% protection against dementia, even if I may not be on my individual that risk chance of risk protection, I would still go ahead and put the hearing aids on and insist on a full correction.
Yeah, I think that's a fair analysis. I'm glad you made that point. And I think this also gets to the fact that, you know, when you have a 35-year-old patient who's got a PhD in electrical engineering and they're at the executive level in their company, they're not the ones we're talking about. It's really the patients who are most at risk. They are the ones who I think we have to focus on for these benefits. I don't think that I would say to that same PhD electrical engineer, gee, you're at risk for cognitive decline. Maybe they are, but the data that we have shows that it's other people. It's not that guy or that woman. So I think we have to go with the science on this. And you know, it's always good to under promise and over deliver. So
yes,
Yeah. All right. Well, Ron, it's a joy to speak with you, and I'm so glad for our friendship and for your academic pursuits. I want to thank you for joining us on this edition of Hearing Matters podcast, and I will look forward to seeing you sometime in 2024.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Good to see you.
Thanks. Take care, Ron.
Thanks again for tuning into the Hearing Matters podcast today. I'm your host, Blaise Delfino, and on behalf of our entire team, thank you so much for the support. Truly, it means so much to us. Head on over to the Apple Podcast app and share your thoughts. What did you like most about this episode, and what do you like most about our podcast? 5-star reviews are always appreciated. And also, head on over to Instagram, hit that follow button, and let's connect. And as a team, we can continue to help our community hear life's story.